Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last in the Progressive Radio Network. It's MBL on PRN.FM. I'm Mike Sleeve along with the good Dr. Guy McPherson. This July 5th, 2016 edition, episode 97 of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. And from Ocean Beach, California. Our thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution. And you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. It's also a call-in show today, so please give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Today's show will focus on our dysfunctional loyalty to the dominant narrative and the variety of forms it comes in. It's a continuation of our show from a couple weeks ago. And sometimes we challenge the narratives of our listeners. Our listeners are free to challenge us as well and have so over the past 96 episodes of Nature Bats Last. We suspect that this show, however, may push us all a little bit. Our topics are not comfortable here at MBL, and today we go outside of our comfort zone, and as my friend Calvin likes to say, a step or two beyond that comfort zone. We are a small community here at MBL, yet collectively we are a clear voice in a chaotic world.
Here's an example of dysfunction from my email inbox 2 weeks ago. It's from somebody who offered to help with my work a few months ago. Quote, I am still doing the same work, encouraging people to buy things they don't need with money they don't have to impress people they don't know. But I started some firm action plan to dramatically change that, hopefully by the end of this year, if we'll get there at all, end quote. And this from somebody who understands where we're at and where we're headed. And yet this person is still uninterested in making significant changes until later, as the Buddhist as the Buddha said a long, long time ago, the trouble is, you think there's time. Yeah. We'll start each topic with what the dominant narrative tells us, and then in the spirit of Louis C.K., we'll consider the maybe or the dysfunction of such a narrative. Let's have Louis C.K. set it up for us from the studio.
Everybody has a competition in their brain of good thoughts and bad thoughts. Hopefully the good thoughts win. For me, I always have both. I have, like, the thing I believe, the good thing. That's the thing I believe. And then there's this thing. And I don't believe it, but it is there. It's always this thing and then this thing. It's become a category in my brain that I call, of course, but maybe. I'll give you an example. Okay, like of course, children who have nut allergies need to be protected. Of course. We have to segregate their food from nuts, have their medication available at all times, and anybody who manufactures or serves food needs to be aware of deadly nut allergies. Of course. But maybe, if touching a nut kills you, you're supposed to die. Of course not. Jesus. I have a nephew who has that. I'd be devastated if something happened to him. But maybe, if we all just do this for 1 year, we're done with nut allergies forever. No, of course not. Of course, if you're fighting for your country and you get shot or hurt, it's a terrible tragedy. Of course. Of course. But maybe if you pick up a gun and go to another country and you get shot, it's not that weird. Maybe if you get shot by the dude you were just shooting at, it's a tiny bit your fault. Of course, slavery is the worst thing that ever happened. Listen, you all clapped for dead kids with the nuts. For kids dying from nuts, you applauded. So you're in this with me now, do you understand? You don't get to cherry pick. Those kids did nothing to you. Of course, slavery is the worst thing that ever happened. Of course it is. Every time it's happened, black people in America, Jews in Egypt, every time a whole race of people has been enslaved, it's a terrible, horrible thing. Of course. But maybe every incredible human achievement in history was done with slaves. Every single thing where you go, how did they build those pyramids? They just threw human death and suffering at them until they were finished. How did we traverse the nation with a railroad so quickly? We just threw Chinese people in caves and blew them up and didn't give a shit what happened to them. There's no end to what you can do when you don't give a fuck about particular people. You can do anything. That's where human greatness comes from, is that we're shitty people, that we fuck others over. Even today, how do we have this amazing microtechnology? Because the factory where they're making these, they jump off the fucking roof because it's a nightmare in there. You really have a choice. You could have candles and horses and be a little kinder to each other, or let someone suffer immeasurably far away just so you can leave a mean comment on YouTube while you're taking a shit.
All right, that sets up where we're headed. Let me give an example of a simplistic nature to tell you where we're headed. Of course, recycling is good for the environment. But maybe if we made things with an eye toward durability, we wouldn't have to recycle at all. Maybe we could reduce and reuse durable devices, and then recycling would be recognized for the big warm cup of nothingness that it actually is. After we point out some of this culture's glaring inconsistencies, a discussion will ensue, first between the two of us and then among our listeners. Mike and I will discuss and then take calls for your input. Some of these examples are meant to push the doomer narrative we all individually hold in our heads to a place where roots can be found. A couple weeks ago, we mentioned three examples. Let's pick up where we left off with item number four. Of course, living off-grid or in an intentional community exposes one to another way of living. Of course it does.
But maybe because we live in a country in a world that is infected by white supremacy, the alternative living scene looks as lily white as a shopping mall in the suburbs. It's very white out here, folks, in the off-grid intentional living land that Guy and I are currently occupying. There's plenty of diversity in other forms, but race is definitely not one of them. Why is that? I'm sure there are a variety of factors, so I'll try and touch upon one. We talk about it a great deal in the show, privilege. Privilege in the form of acceptance by others and communities. Possibly socioeconomic privilege. Possibly the privilege of having time to think about such a lifestyle change instead of being in survival mode. I have no idea because my privilege allows me such ignorance. What I do know is the segregation out here is the same as the segregation in traditional living spaces.
Let's move on to another example. Remember, we're taking your calls. Toll-free number is 888-874-4888. Call the studio. They'll hook you up with us. 888-874-4888. Item number five on our list. Of course Caucasian men work hard for their money. Of course they do. But maybe they are able to take advantage of a system without admitting it or even recognizing it because the system was created by people who look a lot like them. And by them, I mean the two of us. Of course we worked hard during our abbreviated careers, But maybe we benefited greatly because the culture in which we are embedded, there are a certain number of people that are assisted more than others. Maybe we need to recognize our privilege instead of denying it. Maybe we need to at least acknowledge that our paths have been facilitated by patriarchy. Maybe once we do that, we can set ourselves free from some of the cultural shackles. Maybe we can chase that different carrot after all.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me this is, and I've mentioned this countless times in the show, at least from conversations Guy and I have had, the resistance that we generally meet when we talk about the things we talk about, and specifically when it comes to the privilege that we hold, not only as men and white men and as heterosexuals, but living in the wealthiest country in the history of the planet in a time period that's like would be considered magic compared to any other time period. We cannot seem to get through to people that have immense privilege because that narrative is so ingrained. It's literally the thing we've been told our entire lives, that we've earned it all. And those who are below us in any sort of fashion are not necessarily playing the game correctly. There's something wrong with them. There never seems to be something wrong with the circumstances. It's always the individual. And I'm not talking, you know, that people don't have to have personal responsibility or anything like that, because clearly we do. It's just that personal responsibility is a two-way street. And those of us with privilege only see it as a one-way street. That's as far as I can tell. So.
Right. And we've all had numerous conversations with people who are unwilling to even acknowledge the privilege they enjoy. Mm-hmm. They just take it for granted without even noticing, really, that right. that they're embedded within the system that was built by people who look a lot like us.
Yeah, and make no mistake about it. What you're seeing now in the world, the consequences with species extinction and nuclear plants melting down once in a while because we put them in stupid spots or we're using nuclear energy at all this stuff, poverty, it is all a result of people who have, because in order to have, there have to be people who do not have. So privilege is the cause of what we are seeing. And that tends to, what I usually get a response is people think I'm throwing guilt at them. And I don't feel guilty for, you know, the situation I've been born into. I do feel responsible, however, and that's a completely different thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not your fault that you happen to be a white heterosexual man of a certain age, right? I mean, all of those were thrown at you. You didn't have any choice in the matter. And I know some people feel differently about sexual orientation, but the physiology and morphology of organisms tells us otherwise.
Right.
So, it's not as if either of us are saying, stop being white, stop right. being heterosexual, stop, but at least recognize your privilege for what it
right.
is.
Right.
That's what we're looking for here. We're not, as you said, we're not trying to make people feel guilty. We're not interested in blaming people, and that really takes us into our next topic.
All right.
Item number six. Of course the monetary elites are to blame for our global crises. Of course they knew about our myriad ongoing predicaments before the rest of us, and they did nothing to prevent catastrophe. But maybe blaming only the elites ignores the living arrangement that creates, allows, and maintains the existence of poverty and wealth. Maybe we have a responsibility to remove the injustice underlying this set of living arrangements. Maybe we can't cast blame while continuing to hail the system as necessary for our survival, much less calling it good. It's come to be the only thing most of us have ever known, the only set of living arrangements we've ever known, and so we just assume it's the only way that there is to live, and therefore it must be good.
Right, absolutely. This topic came up because I had an online conversation a few days ago, now that I think about it, time's passing really by quickly for me.
It's too much time on Ocean Beach, on the beach, man. You sound very relaxed.
Yeah, too much drinking and smoking. I pointed out it was on Facebook, I pointed out that I have no problem with pointing out the evils of the elite, the global elite. And there are obviously the leaders of this insane culture, but I think we're kidding ourselves if we don't believe our role in all this is just as vital. Elites don't exist without some sort and form of consent. And it's, I get it, manufactured consent. But we also love how civilization feels. It feels good, and we're addicted. And we've talked about this addiction on this show. And the responsibility, again, is a two-way street. It's our responsibility to challenge, resist, and remove such power and privilege. And unfortunately, the cost may be our very lives. And but then again, you know, like we've said repeatedly here, and our guests have said as well, it's never been about us. So we're not in actual shackles. We're not in concentration camps. We're not being persecuted in prison for our beliefs. Many of us are privileged beyond comprehension. And we live in the wealthiest of times, in the wealthiest country of all time. We drive, we fly, we browse the internet, we shop. And in many cases, we are the elite. I mean, just ask someone living in a refugee camp and, you know, show them how you live. You and I and many of our listeners would be considered elite. And we take, you know, and I guess what my question is, what will it take for us to abandon, you know, such a living arrangement? I kind of like a twist on a saying I saw a few years ago, but it's, I like to say treason to privilege is loyalty to life. And that's easier said than done, of course.
Yeah. I mean, to even walk away from the tiniest bit of privilege that you and I enjoy is a challenging task. It's small wonder that most people fit into the category of the person who wrote me a couple of weeks ago, right?
Yeah,
Who keeps doing the same thing, encouraging people to buy things they don't need with money they don't have to impress people they don't know.
Yeah. And I have this conversation all the time with folks. It's hard to pull the trigger, so to speak. It's hard to know what to do first, and if there is such a protocol in a correct order of, okay, so how do I react? I'm aware of what's going on around me, and how do I react in a way that I can still, you know, keep my sanity and function within the confines of who I am and the relationships I have with people and things like that. And I don't have an answer for that, because I think that's just something you got to try and seek out and try and see where it takes you.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's no one size fits all for acknowledging and then stepping away from privilege. Right. I wouldn't recommend the path I took. Certainly not for everybody. I'm sure you feel the same way, Mike.
No, I mean, there is no, and I think that's a mistake I generally make, at least in my writing and my conversations. And I've been trying to become more aware of it, is that I think I often give people the impression that they should be doing what I'm doing, or taking the approach I'm taking. And there are plenty of other people doing other things that are in response to what's going on in the world. And so clearly going out and living in a tent in the middle of nowhere is not a response for everyone. And it could be anything. And I think what you just kind of take a look around and put yourself out there, and the step you take, it kind of attracts those types of people. Like my step was to go out and learn about things that I could do with my hands, and I've attracted an entire community of people like that. And whatever choice you make, I think that's kind of what happens. You start running into those folks, and they start coming into your life.
Yeah, you know, it used to be that there were thousands of different ways to live, mm-hmm. and so there wasn't one model that everybody was following without question, without challenging the assumptions. And so therefore, when you look for another way, there must only be one other way. And I sort of feel like that's where we are now.
Yeah,
we have this one model that everybody strives for. And then for the few people who are willing to look outside of that, they go, oh, there must be one other thing I can do differently.
Right.
You know, it wasn't that many years ago that there were tribes and bands of people living in very different ways within a few miles or tens of miles from each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's no one right way to live, which is something we keep coming back to again and again.
Absolutely. All right. Hey, we have a caller. We have several callers. We have Dave, it looks like, from Chicago. Dave, you there?
Yes, I am. How are you guys? Great to hear
Great.
From you. Hello?
Hello.
Hey,
hello.
Go
yes,
ahead, Dave.
This is Dave, Chicago, Illinois guy. How you doing? Good to hear from you. You know, yesterday was the 4th of July, and every year now, for the past, say, 10 years, since I started reading a lot more, for example, Howard Zinn's History of the United States, you start to realize that what we're celebrating, what we're told we're celebrating, is a complete and utter lie. Because, you know, the founding of the United States was based around land theft, genocide, and slavery. And it breaks my heart that most people I know do not want to face that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those, at least till, it was weird. I don't really think I ever thought about it until I went on the other side of the desk. So when I was a student, it never really crossed my mind. But then when I started teaching about our independence and about the creation of this nation, I used Howard Zinn's book for my first textbook to teach history. And I was learning as the students were learning. And we became angry because we had been lied to. And I remember going through that emotion with my students in the classroom because I had learned it, you know, several minutes before they did.
Well, yeah, and it's, you know, now I feel a lot differently about Thanksgiving than I did when I was a kid. And it was all
right.
Mashed potatoes and turkey, right?
Right.
I had no idea we were celebrating genocide. Who
right.
knew?
Right, yeah, I know.
And you could argue that the 4th of July is not that big a step away from that.
No, not at all. And I think that's the one that kind of gets overlooked.
Yeah. So in this case, we're celebrating conquest along with genocide.
Right. Absolutely.
I guess it's the next step.
It is. All right. Thanks for your
call,
Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
We have Annette from Washington. Annette, you there?
I'm there. I'm here. I'm there and here.
Do you have a question or a comment?
I'm omnipresent. Yeah. I wanted to thank you both so much for raising the issue of white male privilege. I really appreciate that. I've noticed as I kind of force my partner to listen to your shows now and then, I hear him talking to other white men about white male privilege, and it's because of you guys. So the impact that you have is really hard to measure. I just want to encourage you to keep it up, and I think the tangents that you go on just in the organic fashion of having a discussion about how we've gotten to where we are is really important, and you can't see all of the seeds sprouting, but they're sprouting. So I just wanted to thank you for that, and that's it.
Well, thank you very much, Annette.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Annette. And tell your partner it's Mike's fault. I had nothing to do with it. I wasn't there that day.
Yeah, you know, when I started thinking about these things and talking about them and writing about them, and I started attending the White Privilege Conference, such a thing does exist, and it's been around for about 15 years, and when I started to really bring these conversations up to not so much family, but friends and some relatives, I was sort of treated like I had lost my mind because I wasn't necessarily, you know, on script anymore. And I was kind of just pointing out some of the things that I had believed that I knew that other people had believed, because we generally have the same common narrative throughout the conversations I've had through my childhood and my, you know, my high school days and my college days and even my early professional days. It's the conversation is still the same. And when I'm amongst usually other white men, I get a little nervous because inevitably
imagine,
you stand there long enough.
Imagine if you're a woman of color, you think you get nervous being you.
Exactly. If I'm there long enough, something is going to be said where you're going to go. And then it's whether or not you want to you have the privilege or not, whether you want to, you know, to take on that battle. And that's the privilege I have, is sometimes I'm just, I get the choice of not having to deal with it because I don't have to. But many other people don't have that choice because they live it. They just don't have to hear it. They actually experience it. So.
Right. Right. And I mean, the privilege comes up again and again. Thank you, Annette, for structuring the question and making the comment in the way you did so that we can rattle on even further about it. We have another call. Chris from Michigan, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Hey, guy. Hey, Mike. How are you doing?
Hey, pretty great. Thanks, Chris.
I want to start off by saying thank you so much for everything you do, because if I didn't have you guys to listen to every week, I would probably lose my mind. I live out in one of the suburbs in Detroit, and I work at the mall up here. So I pretty much see the pit of civilization right here, and have to work with it every day. I guess I started realizing these things after I graduated and wasn't able to find work with my degree, and I just had this feeling that something was wrong, something just didn't feel right to me. I've always kind of been an intuitive person, and for some reason, one night I was bored and I decided to watch, Al Gore's documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. And that's the first time, and I've graduated with a bachelor's degree in science, and this is the first time I ever learned about the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And my heart just about dropped when I saw it. I could not believe that all this time I was in school getting a science degree, I never heard about, I didn't even realize this. And then I saw a guy on Peak Moment with Jeanette Donaldson, and it just kind of, that's where the rabbit hole started, I guess you could say. So I guess it's just kind of hard to, it feels like I'm living in a sort of matrix, like I go to work every day and I'm trying
you
to
are living in a matrix.
Out with that.
Yeah,
it's crazy. And you try to talk to people about these things.
He's cutting in and out, isn't he?
They just don't want to hear about it at all. You get people that immediately look at you like you're crazy for even, wanting to talk about some of these things. And but I know, and I sometimes feel like I am crazy. But then I looked, like last weekend, I went up to in the northern part of the state where my family lives. And I went to my grandparents' house, and they live out in the country. And my grandpa has a beautiful garden he's been working on for the last 20 years, beautiful plants, everything. And they live way out in the country. And I started noticing the garden just looked so shriveled and like it was just really struggling to thrive. And then so I was taking my partner, I brought him up and showing him around the yard. And all of a sudden I came across all these dead trees I remember playing in as a child. These pine trees were just all dead. And it was just really shocking to me. And it's just shocking. I got that feeling of grief, when I saw his garden struggling like that. It just made me feel so awful inside. I get these moments where I just feel so much. I'll see it like that right in front of me, and it's just shocking. I don't know.
Well, it's only shocking. It's only demoralizing. It's only depressing if you pay attention. So you could join the masses and not pay any attention.
Of course, after you've seen it, you can't really do that anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Was it Arundhati Roy who wrote, "Once you've seen it, you can't unsee it"?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's just, in the whole drive from Detroit up to where my family lives, I just was looking out the window and you see dead trees everywhere. I mean, nobody's talking about it at all. I did mention it to my grandparents, and I think they have a hard time. They probably have a lot of cognitive dissonance, like a lot of other people do and stuff. And I asked my grandpa, why are those trees dead? And he said, well, maybe they're just old or something. But it's got to be more than that, I would assume.
Yeah. There's a lot of stress on trees because of a lot of reasons, climate change being among them, obviously. But, you don't have to look far if you're paying attention at all to notice that something is wrong, that something is different, that the system is, whether we're talking about the economic system or the ecological system, the environmental system, it's different than it was 10, 15, 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. So if you have been paying attention, it's pretty hard to not notice. When I'm on tour, I frequently run into people who spend a lot of time outdoors. They're gardeners, or they work for the state forestry department or whatever. And those are the people who know what's going on, because they see the change. For other people, it's pretty easy to ignore the change because they got their heads down. They're on the treadmill. They're pursuing their life. They're doing something that they think is independent of the ecosystem in which we are all embedded. And so they don't pay a lot of attention to it. But that, yeah. I mean, it's a great point.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you have that lens on, Chris. Once you put that lens on and view the world through, you know, lack of a better word here, the doomer lens, it's almost like watching a movie. I sit there and I find myself just observing so much more than I used to and watching what is happening in front of me. And it's just in conversations with people. Although I have noticed that there is this underlying sort of recognition that everything is not okay, because people make little comments here and there. And I don't know if it's necessarily because they're talking to me, because some of these folks I just met, but little things that, you know, they know certain things aren't going to be around much longer. So I think there is something, there is some sort of, I don't know what, if it's a blinking notification in our consciousness or what, but the people on some level, a lot of people do know things aren't well.
Yeah, it's a different world than the world we grew up in. And it's just one minor example of that. You would expect, in the absence of planetary warming, you would expect that every month would have a 50% chance of being slightly cooler than usual. And the last time we had a slightly cooler than usual month was February of 1985.
Wow.
We are experiencing a warmed world.
Yeah.
It's a completely different world than existed when I was a kid.
Right. Right. All right. Thanks for the call, Chris. Great commentary. And I'm glad that you're part of the community that we have here, because we're all kind of getting through this together. So thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Okay.
So
next one.
Yeah, you're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. This is a call-in show. Give us a holler toll-free at 888-874-4888. Item number 7. Of course we need scientific data to validate our opinions on near-term human extinction. Of course we can't reach that horrific conclusion in the absence of very strong evidence. But maybe a trip to the nearest shopping mall, along with about 15 minutes observing human behavior, is all that's needed to reach that conclusion. And maybe, just maybe, coming to the conclusion that society's impending collapse will lead to the meltdown of 440 nuclear power plants and therefore an extinction-level event for our species doesn't require a ton of research and data, but rather some thinking from those people with half a brain or maybe even more.
Yeah, again, this was another thread I came across, and the discussion was actually about you, Guy, as it usually is. I'm pretty sure it was from a Facebook group that you had been banished from, where I still lurk once in a while. But they were discussing near-term human extinction, and, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary data. And, you know, I don't have any problem with that. But when it came up about, you know, the power plants that will be left behind after economic collapse, someone was like, well, nobody's done a study on this, so we don't really know if we're going to go extinct. And I was like, is this a real conversation?
Well,
like, I just was like, holy cow.
Sometimes the word unprecedented is actually in order.
Yes.
We're talking about the meltdown of the world's, never mind 400 change nuclear power plants, how about 1,200 pools
yes,
of spent fuel rods? Pools of spent fuel rods that are going to be exposed to the atmosphere and produce the kinds of fires this planet has never seen. Do you think that won't be problematic?
Yeah, but people are still going, yeah, okay, but See, do you think we have a chance?
Yeah. This is, it's great they're all the way up to stage three bargaining already.
I mean, it's unbelievable. If another planet was about to collide with the Earth, I would not be going, well, you know, there really hasn't been a study on this. I think we might be able to pull out of this. It's just insane to me. Like, is there a number that maybe this person's thinking? Well, we could survive 440. But 441, I need a study on.
Right. Must have a study on that one.
Yeah. I mean, it's just at some point, I don't know when common sense kicks in. And maybe it doesn't in this narrative. It just never quite does. Even if you – and this is from individuals who are who are doomers and claim to be doomers. But there's certain aspects of the narrative that they're just not willing to go to. And this was on one of the near-term human extinction pages. So,
right. Well, it was Voltaire who once said common sense is not so common.
Yeah.
That was true quite a while ago, by the way.
Oh, well. So, what else are we going to talk about?
Well, we can move into a climate change update. And
let's do that.
In anticipation of a flood of calls coming in.
Okay.
We are taking your calls, and probably we won't make fun of you if you call now, because we're, you know, sort of desperate for conversation. So, toll-free number is 888-874-4888. But, all right, let's do a little climate change news. According to a paper in the June 23rd, 2016 issue of Geophysical Research Letters, climate sensitivity increases as the planet warms. Specifically, according to the paper's abstract, quote, future global warming from anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions will depend on climate feedbacks, the effect of which is expressed by climate sensitivity. We obtain constrained estimates of CO2 and climate sensitivity before and during the PETM and of the PETM carbon input amount and nature. Sensitivity increased into the PETM, end quote. In other words, the warmer it gets, the warmer it's likely to get. PETM refers to the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, which transpired about 55 million years ago. So the bottom line there is the warmer it gets, the warmer it's likely to get. Climate sensitivity increases under warmer temperatures.
Got it.
A paper published in the June 29th, 2016 issue of Nature reports that climate change is disrupting the seasonal behavior of Britain's plants and animals. Phenology is the study of timing, such as the average flowering date of a plant or the average migration date of a duck. The research in this case analyzed 10,003 long-term phenological data sets of 812 of the UK's marine, freshwater, and land-based plant and animal species collected between 1960 and 2012 on everything from fish spawning to plant flowering. According to the final paragraph of the paper, quote, our approach makes the simplifying assumption that climatic change has an overriding influence upon seasonality. Nevertheless, our results suggest that systematic differences in climate sensitivity could result in widespread phenological desynchronization, end quote. Well, duh.
Duh.
Every species is well adapted to a specific set of environmental conditions. That includes our species, by the way. Changing the conditions causes loss of habitat for every single species. For some scientists, apparently, this is quite a novel finding. But this is the kind of thing that just drives me crazy, that we're still stuck on how quickly habitat is changing and that might mean something. So it's the conversation we just had, Mike, where we're still bargaining right into the future, even as the future is behind us.
Right, and still kind of hoping that that person is out there that's going to solve it.
Right, somebody else, not
right.
us.
Right, somebody who hasn't been born yet.
Yes, counting on a miracle. Okay, I want to talk about the video that went viral. Recent claims by Paul Beckwith and Robert Fanny. Robert Fanny writes under the pen name Scribbler. Right. And those claims have been making the rounds and even elicited a response from the mouthpiece of Empire, the Washington Post.
Right.
Specifically, Beckwith picked up on the idea from Scribbler that the northern jet stream crossed the equator in late June and that this mixing in the atmosphere was, quote, unprecedented. Scribbler's post was titled, "Gigantic Gravity Waves to Mix Summer with Winter? Wrecked jet stream now runs from pole to pole." Beckwith, of course, went on to make a selfie video focused on the idea under a blog entry titled, "Jet Stream Crosses the Equator. Unprecedented?" He and Scribbler both presented satellite evidence, and the same pattern was observed by Robert Westenra of Seymour Rocks on the 4th of July, so several days after the initial reports. The rapid attack by Jason Samenow at the Washington Post surprised me, in part because it was not written by their usual reporter on the topic of abrupt climate change, Chris Mooney. Not surprisingly, the story in the Post focused on credentials, not evidence. It was a hit piece on the credentials of Scribbler and Beckwith. I'll quote from the piece in the Post. Quote, "I reached out to several atmospheric scientists who have graduate degrees and are trusted sources in their profession for their reaction to these claims. Without exception, they said airflow between the hemispheres is not at all uncommon. To be clear, the hypothesis that global warming is destabilizing the polar jet stream is a legitimate idea that has been published in peer-reviewed journals, though it remains controversial. But even a scientist who developed the hypothesis, Jennifer Francis, a professor of meteorology at Rutgers University, suggested it had been misapplied by Scribbler and Beckwith. She said, "I'd say cross-equator flow cannot be unprecedented, maybe not even all that unusual." End quote. So I've been asked to provide my opinion on this kerfuffle. Here goes. After a little study, actually very little study, I agree with the Post with respect to the hyperbolic language of Scribbler and Beckwith. I doubt the phenomenon they describe is truly unprecedented. This is not to say the situation is not alarming, as indicated by the Post. The Post continues to pacify the passive citizenry with the usual name-calling strategy, thereby failing to differentiate between alarmists and an alarming situation. The situation is clearly alarming, and the Post is inappropriately calling those sounding the alarm alarmists. So whereas on the one hand I agree with the Post and their laser-like focus on the word unprecedented, on the other hand I disagree with the conclusion of the Post, which suggests there is no planetary emergency. It's all business as usual from the mouthpiece of empire. So whereas the pattern is clearly unusual, it's almost certainly not without precedence. For the Post to conclude there is no planetary emergency is irresponsible, although I'm not surprised. An aware populace, which has good reason to be alarmed, might actually live differently than the current passive citizenry. And from the perspective of imperialism, different is bad, as we've already discussed on this show. The industrial economy might suffer. Corporate profits might decline if people start thinking and then living a little differently than they're doing so now.
And that will not be allowed.
No, no, there is one way to live.
Right. All right. We do have a caller. Do you want to jump to the caller?
Yes, please.
All right. We have Pamela from Milwaukee. Pamela, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last.
What you got, Pamela?
Could barely follow your comment on the study you just quoted and Robert Scribner, although I did read that. But the previous one, I just don't think we needed to study on. It's the seasons have been changing where I am in Milwaukee really noticeably for at least the last decade. And in my garden, the things I plant seasonally to eat, like peas, are really confused. We go, we can go from a day that feels like spring to a day that feels like late summer, back to spring, you know, 50s to 90s, back to 50s, and a little rain, and then a lot of rain, and they're as confused as I am.
There's a lot of confusion out there.
There's a ton of confusion. Plants that used to, flowers that used to bloom in on the 4th of July really don't do much until August, unless you've bought them at a nursery and you put them in, you know, as annuals as opposed to perennials. So, you know, it just goes with the theme of faster than expected. I wonder, you know, really when the food supplies start to go, when I notice it here, and this is the grain belt.
Right. And you know, I talked earlier in the show about phenology, the study of timing. And there's actually been a lot of research done on this. One of my former graduate students is the director of the National Phenology Network, which is a program administered by the United States Geological Survey. And it was that colleague, Jake Wiltine, with whom I wrote edited a book on climate change in 2002 that led to my conclusion of near-term human extinction as a result of climate change. And so he's been studying, basically since he left graduate school, he's been studying the phenology through this huge network. And I mentioned the rapidly changing phenology series of timing of events in the UK at the beginning of the climate change update here on this show. And, you know, as is consistent with the mainstream media and as we already mentioned for the Washington Post, we're in a planetary emergency. And continuing to nibble around at the edges, as the mainstream media have done, to continue to write as if we are not in an emergency, that, oh, look, every other organism on the planet is having difficulty adapting and the timing is all wrong. They're flowering earlier and dying and they're not fruiting at all and species are not coming out of hibernation and so on. To not declare that a planetary emergency, in my opinion, is irresponsible. And that's what I keep seeing everywhere. And in fact, the climate scientists who conduct these studies reach these conclusions that are so mild as to be, for me at least, personally quite annoying.
Annoying, and although I love the word phenology and I plan to use it often, never really had heard it before. But denial, I think, is more likely what it is. I've noticed amongst my friends who I choose to chance this conversation with, and I'll just finish up with this and let you guys get on with it. Those with children find it much more difficult to wrap their mind around this concept. And I guess I can understand that. I don't happen to have children. Not to be able to imagine the world going on, at least as we know it now, into their future, into their old age, and the planet for their children, you know, their grandchildren. You know, it's almost like
there were people who talked about it a generation or two ago. My parents, I can clearly recall when I was 10 or 12 years old, them pointing out, without using the words, many of the disadvantages of civilization. And they were saying, we can't go on like this, or things are going to be totally screwed up when our poor son gets older. And I'm older now, you know, quite a bit, in fact. And so people used to talk about these topics that are now taboo. We used to have those conversations around the dinner table, but it seems like now there's not much of that conversation. It's as taboo as talking about death and sex.
Yeah, or what medications you're on or not on, or are they safe?
Right.
It can go on. But thank you guys for the conversation, as always. Thank you.
Thanks, Pamela. Yeah, you know, it's the people that we've talked about like this again, the people that are on, you know, the ground, necessarily actually working in the dirt, the people that are noticing it, like Pamela, with, you know, what's growing and what's not growing and what used to be here and what is no longer here. You know, when you're surrounded by pavement, I mean, you don't have to deal with any of those things. Yeah, you know, you just kind of pay attention to the economy.
Right. And, you know, it's the 0.1 percenters or whatever we call them this week, that deny where we're at because they're not outdoors. They're hovering over the computer screens like we're doing now and spending a lot of time making a lot of money, relatively divorced from the natural world.
Yeah, you know, I wonder what it would take for you know, mainstream media like the Post, what constitutes a global catastrophe or emergency, you know, what has to happen?
Oh, I'm pretty sure I got that one.
I do.
Failure of one of the big banks.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Because how about anything on, you think what would have to happen maybe environmentally where somebody would go, whoa, wait a minute, like that's not good. Like, I mean, millions or billions of fish dying? I don't know. I mean,
we're already seeing that.
I know, but like literally every beach in the world they're washing up on. Then maybe people go, there might be something wrong here.
Well, maybe so. Maybe.
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 Of course they would.
Of course they would. Of course they would.
Maybe they'd be thinking, hey, free fish.
Right. And we didn't even have to put out a net. They just came to us.
Right, right.
It's a gift.
It is a gift. All right.
There was a writer who, when I was a kid, wrote these books with horrible titles. And they were probably pretty horrible books, but I was too young to distinguish sophomoric humor from the other stuff. Yeah. And I remember the name of one of these guys' books was Don't Sniff a Gift Fish. So there you go. All those fish dying on the beach. Don't sniff those, just eat them.
Just eat them. Okay. Good. All right, you got anything left?
Paragraphs.
Sweet, go ahead.
I've added a couple of the following short paragraphs to the top of my long, often updated essay. And I think these two paragraphs tell pretty much the whole story. The Great Dying wiped out at least 90% of the species on Earth due to an abrupt rise in global average temperature about 252 million years ago. The vast majority of complex life became extinct. It seems Earth is headed for a similar global average temperature in the very near future. The recent and near future rises in temperature are occurring and will occur at least three orders of magnitude faster than the worst of all prior mass extinctions. Habitat for human animals is disappearing throughout the world, and abrupt climate change has barely begun. In the near future, habitat for Homo sapiens will be gone. Shortly thereafter, all humans will die. There is no precedence in planetary history for events unfolding today. As a result, relying on prior events to predict the near future is unwise. And I'm using the word precedence with great care and purpose in this case. This, you know, what we're seeing, and it's not just climate change, it's not just abrupt climate change. What we're seeing is truly unprecedented with respect to the planet. You think you can trigger the sixth mass extinction and have it create no problem for you?
I mean, there's no pulling back from that.
No.
Netball.
No.
Was rolling.
Right. And as we now know, there is approximately a 10 year lag between emission of carbon dioxide and when the maximum heating associated with that carbon dioxide is realized. So
yeah, so absolutely. I think that's the biggest thing. People don't realize two things. The speed of which things are happening, which you pointed out, and they miss the obvious. I think they forget that we literally need habitat.
Right. I'm pretty sure that's the case, because we tend to think of ourselves as very special. I was talking to Corey Morningstar this morning on the telephone. We've conversed with Corey several times on the show.
Right.
And, you know, she has several children, and yet she can not only think the unthinkable, but she can speak about the unspeakable, that is lack of habitat for our species in the very near future. So it's she understands habitat, and she's not a conservation biologist. You're not a conservation biologist.
No.
You know, it's not the most difficult concept to understand.
No, and I think you can have these conversations with your children once they understand the concept of death.
Right.
I mean, once you understand death, all you're talking about after that is a way to get there.
Right, and you're talking about it at larger scale, so you're not talking about a population of fish washing up. You're talking about an entire species of fish going down.
Yeah.
You know, it was almost 5 years later, just short of 5 years after the United Nations Environment Program put out their report indicating that we are driving to extinction 150 to 200 species a day. It was almost 5 years later that the incredibly conservative Referee Journal literature concludes that the sixth mass extinction is already underway. That tells you how conservative the Referee Journal literature is. Yeah. A coinciding interview with the paper's lead author, Gerardo Ceballos, who we interviewed on the show, includes this line from him, quote, "Life would take many millions of years to recover, and our species itself would likely disappear early on."
Yeah.
I don't know how you can be any more clear than that. And yet, the denial is rampant.
It is. We just need more studies to tell us otherwise. All right. Well, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show. And please share the link widely on other groups so people can listen to the show. And continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. And follow my work every Sunday at the Good Men Project. We'll see you on the radio the first Tuesday afternoon of each month from now on at 3 p.m. Eastern. And that means our next show will be broadcast on a Tuesday afternoon, the 2nd of August. And if you miss us live, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM or at Stitcher.com or rate us on iTunes. And thanks again to our listeners. Our callers today were fantastic. And to Afrozen for his music. Until next time, remember, of course, the dominant culture has been very clever. Of course it has. But maybe.
Nature Bats Last.